Eisenhorn, Xenos, by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Chapter 1. A cold coming. Death in the dormant vaults. Some puritanical reflections. Hunting the recidivist Murdin Eichlone, I came to Hubris in the dormant of 240 M41, as the Imperial Sidereal calendar has it. Dormant lasted 11 months of Hubris's 29-month lunar year, and the only signs of life were the custodians with their lighted poles and heat gowns, patrolling the precincts of the hibernation tombs. Within those sulking basalt and ceramite vaults, the grandees of Hubris slept, dreaming in crypts of aching ice, awaiting thaw, the middle season between dormant and vital. Even the air was frigid. Frost encrusted the tombs, and a thick cake of ice covered the featureless land. Above, star patterns twinkled in the curious, permanent night. One of them was Hubris's sun, so far away now. Come thaw, Hubris would spin into the warm embrace of its star again. Then it would become a blazing globe. Now it was just a fuzz of light. As my gun cutter set down on the landing cross at Tomb Point, I had pulled on an internally heated bodyskin and swathes of sturdy, insulated foul weather gear, but still the perilous cold cut through me now. My eyes watered, and the tears froze on my lashes and cheeks. I remembered the details of the cultural brief my savant had prepared, and quickly lowered my frost visor, trembling as warm air began to circulate under the plastic mask. Custodians, alerted to my arrival by astropathic hails, stood waiting for me at the base of the landing cross. Their lighted poles dipped in obeisance in the frozen night, and the air steamed with the heat that bled from their cloaks. I nodded to them, showing their leader my badge of office. An ice car awaited, a rust-coloured arrowhead 20 meters long, mounted on ski-blade runners and spiked tracks. It carried me away from the landing cross, and I left the winking signal lights and the serrated dagger shape of my gun-cutter behind in the perpetual winter night. The spiked tracks kicked up blizzards of rime behind us. Ahead, despite the lamps, the landscape was black and impenetrable. I rode with Loris Vibben and 3 custodians in a cabin lit only by the amber glow of the craft's control panel. Heating vents recessed in the leather seats breathed out warm, stale air. A custodian handed back a data slate to Vibben. She looked at it cursorily and passed it on to me. I realized my frost visor was still down. I raised it and began to search my pockets for my eyeglasses. With a smile, Vibben produced them from within her own swaddled, insulated garb. I nodded thanks, put them on my nose, and began to read. I was just calling up the last plates of text when the ice car halted. "Processional 212," announced one of the custodians. We dismounted, sliding our visors down into place. Jewels of frost flakes fluttered in the blackness around us, sparkling as they crossed through the ice car's lamp beams. I've heard of bitter cold. Emperor, grace me, I never feel it again. Biting, crippling, actually bitter to taste on the tongue. Every joint in my frame protested and creaked. My hands and my mind were numb. That was not good. Processional 212 was a hibernation tomb at the west end of the Great Imperial Avenue. It housed 12,142 members of the Hubris ruling elite. We approached the great monument, crunching up the black, frost-coated steps. I halted. "Where are the tomb's custodians?" "Making their rounds," I was told. I glanced at Vibben and shook my head. She slid her hand into her fur-edged robes. "Knowing we approach," I urged, addressing the custodian again. "Knowing we expect to meet them." "I will check," said the custodian, the one who had circulated the slate. He pushed on up the steps, the phosphor light on his pole bobbing. The other two seemed ill at ease. I beckoned to Vibben, so she would follow me up after the leader. We found him on a lower terrace, gazing at the strewn bodies of four custodians, their light poles fizzling out around them.
How?
He stammered.
Stay back,
Vibben told him, and drew her weapon. Its tiny amber armed rune glowed in the darkness. I took out my blade, igniting it. It hummed. The south entry of the tombs was open. Shafts of golden light shone out. All my fears were rapidly being confirmed. We entered, Vibben sweeping the place from side to side with her handgun. The hall was narrow and high, lit by chemical glow globes. Intruding frost was beginning to mark the polished basalt walls. A few meters inside, another custodian lay dead in a stiffening mirror of blood. We stepped over him. To each side, hallways opened up, admitting us to the hibernation stacks. In every direction, rows and rows of ice berths ranged down the smoothed basalt chambers. It was like walking into the Imperium's grandest morgue. Vibben swept soundlessly to the right, and I went left. I admit I was excited by now, eager to close and conclude a business that had lasted 6 years. Eichlone had evaded me for 6 whole years. I studied his methods every day and dreamed of him every night. Now I could smell him. I raised my visor. Water was pattering from the roof. Thaw water. It was growing warmer in here. In their ice berths, some of the dim figures were stirring. Too early. Far too early. Eichlone's first man came at me from the west as I crossed a trunk junction corridor. I spun, the power sword in my hand, and cut through his neck before his ice axe could land. The second came from the south, the third from the east, and then more. More. A blur. As I fought, I heard furious shooting from the vaults away to my right. Vibben was in trouble. I could hear her over the vox link in our hoods.
Eisenhorn! Eisenhorn!
I wheeled and cut. My opponents were all dressed in heat gowns and carried ice tools that made proficient weapons. Their eyes were dark and unforthcoming. Though they were fast, there was something in them that suggested they were doing this mindlessly, by order. The power sword, an antique and graceful weapon, blessed by the provost of Inks himself, spun in my hand. With 5 abrupt moves I made corpses out of them and left their blood vapour drifting in the air.
Eisenhorn!
I turned and ran. I splashed heavily down a corridor sluiced with meltwater. More shots from ahead. A sucking cry. I found Vibben face down across a freezer tube, frozen blood gluing her to the sub-zero plastic. 8 of Eichlone's servants lay sprawled around her. Her weapon lay just out of reach of her clawing hand, the spent cell ejected from the grip. I am 42 standard years old, in my prime by Imperial standards, young by those of the Inquisition. All my life I have had a reputation for being cold, unfeeling. Some have called me heartless, ruthless, even cruel. I am not. I am not beyond emotional response or compassion. But I possess, and my masters count this as perhaps my paramount virtue, a singular force of will. Throughout my career it has served me well to draw on this facility and steel myself, unflinching, at all that this wretched galaxy can throw at me. To feel pain or fear or grief is to allow myself a luxury I cannot afford. Loris Vibben had served with me for 5.5 years. In that period she had saved my life twice. She saw herself as my aid and my bodyguard, yet, in truth, she was more a companion and a fellow warrior. When I recruited her from the clan slums of Tornish, it was for her combat skills and brutal vigour. But I came to value her just as much for her sharp mind, soft wit, and clear head. I stared down at her body for a moment. I believe I may have uttered her name. I extinguished my power sword and, sliding it into its scabbard, moved back into the shadows on the far side of the hibernation gallery. I could hear nothing except the increasingly persistent thaw drip. Freeing my sidearm from its leather rig under my left armpit, I checked its load and opened a vox link. Eichlone was undoubtedly monitoring all traffic in and out of Processional 212, so I used Glossier, an informal verbal cipher known only to myself and my immediate colleagues. Most Inquisitors develop their own private languages for confidential communication, some more sophisticated than others. Glossia, the basics of which I had designed 10 years before, was reasonably complex and had evolved organically with use. Thorn wishes Aegis, rapturous beasts below. Aegis, arising, the colours of space, Betancourt responded immediately and correctly. Rose Thorn, abundant, by flame-light crescent. A pause. By flame-light crescent. Confirm. Confirm. Razor Delphus pathway. Pattern ivory. Pattern denied. Pattern crucible. Aegis, arising. The link broke. He was on his way. He had taken the news of Vibben's death as hard as I expected. I trusted that would not affect his performance. Midas Betancourt was a hot-blooded, impetuous man, which was partly why I liked him, and used him. I moved out of the shadows again, my sidearm raised. A Scipio-pattern naval pistol, finished in dull chrome with inlaid ivory grips, it felt reassuringly heavy in my gloved hand. 10 rounds, everyone a fat, blunt man-stopper, were spring-loaded into the slide inside the grip. I had 4 more armed slides just like it in my hip pocket. I forget where I acquired the Scipio. It had been mine for a few years. One night, 3 years before, Vibben had prized off the ceramite grip plates with their touch-worn, machine-stamped engravings of the Imperial Aquila and the Navy motto, and replaced them with ivory grips she had etched herself. A common practice on Tornish, she informed me, handing the weapon back the next day. The new grips were like crude scrimshaw, showing on each side a poorly executed human skull through which a thorny rose entwined, emerging through an eye socket, shedding cartoon droplets of blood. She'd inlaid carmine gems into the droplets to emphasize their nature. Below the skull, my name was scratched in a clumsy scroll. I had laughed. There had been times when I'd almost been too embarrassed to draw the gang-marked weapon in a fight. Now she was dead. I realized what an honor had been paid to me through that devoted work. I made a promise to myself. I would kill Eiklone with this gun. As a devoted member of His High Majesty the God Emperor's Inquisition, I find my philosophy bends towards that of the Amalathians. To the outside galaxy, members of our orders appear much alike. An inquisitor is an inquisitor, a being of fear and persecution. It surprises many that, internally, we are riven with clashing ideologies. I know it surprised Vibben. I spent one long afternoon trying to explain the differences. I failed. To express it in simple terms, some inquisitors are Puritans and some are radicals. Puritans believe in and enforce the traditional station of the Inquisition, working to purge our galactic community of any criminal or malevolent element, the triumvirate of evil, alien, mutant, and demon. Anything that clashes with the pure rule of mankind, the preachings of the Ministerium, and the letter of imperial law is subject to a Puritan Inquisitor's attention. Hard line, traditional, merciless. That is the Puritan way. Radicals believe that any methods are allowable if they accomplish the inquisitorial task. Some, as I understand it, actually embrace and use forbidden resources such as the warp itself as weapons against the enemies of mankind. I have heard the arguments often enough. They appall me. Radical belief is heretical. I am a Puritan by calling and an Amalathian by choice. The ferociously strict ways of the monodominant philosophy oft-times entices me, but there is precious little subtlety in their ways, and thus it is not for me. Amalathians take our name from the conclave at Mount Amalath. Our endeavour is to maintain the status quo of the Imperium, and we work to identify and destroy any persons or agencies that might destabilize the power of the Imperium from without or within. We believe in strength through unity. Change is the greatest enemy. We believe the God Emperor has a divine plan, and we work to sustain the Imperium in stability until that plan is made known. We deplore factions and infighting. Indeed, it is sometimes a painful irony that our beliefs mark us as a faction within the political helix of the Inquisition. We are the steadfast spine of the Imperium, its antibodies, fighting disease, insanity, injury, invasion. I can think of no better way to serve, no better way to be an Inquisitor. So, you have me then, pictured. Gregor Eisenhorn, Inquisitor, Puritan, Amalathian, 42 years old, standard, an Inquisitor for the past 18 years. I am tall and broad at the shoulders, strong, resolute. I have already told you of my force of will, and you will have noted my prowess with a blade. What else is there? Am I clean-shaven? Yes. My eyes are dark, my hair darker and thick. These things matter little. Come, and let me show you how I killed Eiklone. Chapter 2. The Dead Awake. Betancourt's Temper. Elucidations by Amos. I clung to the shadows, moving through the great tomb as silently as I knew how. A terrible sound rolled through the thawing vaults of Processional 212, fists and palms beating at coffin hoods, wailing, gurgling. The sleepers were waking, their frigid bodies sore with hibernation sickness, trapped in their caskets. No honor guard of trained cryogeneers waited to unlock them, to sluice their organs with warming biofluids, or inject stimulants, or massage paralyzed extremities. Thanks to Eiklone's efforts, 12,142 members of the planet's ruling class were being roused early into the bitter season of dormant, and roused without the necessary medical supervision. I had no doubt that they would all suffocate in minutes. My mind scrolled back through the details my savant had prepared for me. There was a central control room where I could disengage the ice berth locks and at least free them all. But to what good? Without the resuscitation teams, they would fail and perish. And if I hunted out the control room, Eiklone would have time to escape. In glossier code, I communicated this quandary to Betancourt and told him to alert the custodians. He informed me, after a pause, that crash teams and relief crews were on their way. But why? The question was still there. Why was Eiklone doing this? A massed killing was nothing unusual for a follower of Chaos. But there had to be a point, above and beyond the deaths themselves. I was pondering this as I crossed a hallway deep in the west wing of the processional. Frantic beating sounds came from the berths all around, and a pungent mix of ice water and biofluid spurted from the drain taps and cascaded over the floor. A shot rang out. A las shot. It missed me by less than a hand's breadth, and exploded through the headboard of an ice berth behind me. Immediately the frantic hammering in that berth stopped, and the waters running out of its ducts were stained pink. I fired the Scipio down the vault, startled by the noise it made. Two more las shots flicked down at me. Taking cover behind a stone bulkhead, I emptied a clip down the length of the gallery, the spent shell cases smoking in the air as the pumping slide ejected them. A hot vapor of cordite blew back at me. I swung back into cover, exchanging clips. A few more spits of laser drizzled past me. Then a voice.
Eisenhorn! Gregor! Is that you?
Eiklone. I knew his thin voice at once. I didn't answer.
You're dead, you know, Gregor. Dead like they all are. Dead, dead, dead. Step out and make it quick.
He was good. I'll give him that. My legs actually twitched, actually started to walk me clear of cover into the open. Eiklone was infamous across a dozen settled systems for his mind powers and mesmeric tone. How else had he managed to get these dark-eyed fools to do his bidding? But I have similar skills, and I have honed them well. There is a time to use mind or voice tricks gently to draw out your target, and there are times to use them like a stub gun at point-blank range. It was time for the latter. I pitched my voice, balanced my mind, and yelled, "Show yourself first!" Eiklone didn't succumb. I didn't expect him to. Like me, he had years of resilience training. but his two gunmen were easy meat. The first strode directly out into the middle of the gallery hallway, dropping his lasgun with a clatter. The Scipio made a hole in the middle of his forehead and blew his brains out behind him in a grotesque pink mist. The other stumbled out on his heels, realized his mistake, and began firing. One of his las bolts scorched the sleeve of my jacket. I squeezed the pistol's trigger, and the Scipio bucked and snarled in my tight grip. The round penetrated his head under his nose, splintered on his upper teeth, and blew the sides of his skull out. He staggered and fell, dead fingers firing his las rifle again and again, blowing the fascias out of the hibernation stalls around him. Putrid water, biofluid, and plastic fragments poured out, and some screams became louder. I could hear footsteps above the screams. Eichlone was running. I ran too, across the vaults, passing gallery after gallery. The screaming, the pounding. God Emperor help me, I will never forget that. Thousands of frantic souls waking up to face an agonizing death. Damn Eichlone. Damn him to hell and back. Crossing the third gallery, I saw him, running parallel to me. He saw me too. He wheeled and fired. I ducked back as the blasts of his las pistol shrieked past. A glimpse was all I'd had. A short, wiry man, dressed in brown heat robes, his goatee neatly trimmed, his eyes twinkling with malice. I fired back, but he was running again. I ran on, glimpsed him down the next gallery, and fired again. At the next gallery, nothing. I waited and pulled off my outer robe. It was getting hot and damp in processional 212. When another minute passed and there was still no sign, I began to edge down the gallery towards his last position, gun raised. I would have died right there had not the Joker gods of fate and chance played their hand. At the moment Eichlone fired, several cryotubes finally gave way, and yowling, naked, blistered humans staggered out into the corridor, clawing with ice-webbed hands, mewling, vomiting, blind and ice-burned. Eichlone's shots tore three of them apart and hideously wounded a fourth. Had it not been for them, those last shots would have finished me. Footsteps hurried. He was running again. I pushed on down the gallery, stepping over the blasted ruins of the sleepers who had inadvertently spared me. The wounded one, a middle-aged female, compromised and naked as she lay in the meltwater, clutched at my leg, begging for salvation. Eichlone's gunfire had all but disemboweled her. I hesitated. A merciful headshot now would spare her everything. But I could not. Once they were awake, the hierarchy of Hubris would not understand a mercy killing. I would be trapped here for years, fighting my case through every court in their legislature. I shook off her desperate grip and moved on. Do you think me weak? Flawed? Do you hate me for setting my inquisitorial role above the needs of one agonized being? If you do, I commend you. I think of that woman still, and hate the fact I left her to die slowly. But if you hate me, I know this about you. You are no inquisitor. You don't have the moral strength. I could have finished her, and my soul might have been relieved, but that would have been an end to my work. And I always think of the thousands, millions, perhaps, who would die worse deaths but for my actions. Is that arrogance? Perhaps. And perhaps arrogance is therefore a virtue of the Inquisition. I would gladly ignore one life in agony if I could save 100, 1,000, more. Mankind must suffer so that mankind can survive. It's that simple. Ask Amos. He knows. Still, I dream of her, and her bloody anguish. Pity me for that at least. I pressed on through the tomb vaults, and after another gallery or two, progress became slow. Hundreds of sleepers had now freed themselves. The hallways were jostling with their frantic, blind pain. I skirted those I could, staying out of the way of grasping hands, stepping over some who lay twitching and helpless on the floor. The collective sounds of their braying and whimpering were almost intolerable. There was a hot, fetid stench of decay and bio-waste. Several times I had to break free of hands that seized me. Grotesquely, the horror made it easier to track Eichlone. Every few paces another sleeper lay dead or dying, callously gunned down by murderers in desperate flight. I found a service door forced open at the end of the next file, and entered a deep stairwell that wound up through the edifice. Chemical globes suspended in wall brackets lit the way. From far above I heard shots, and I ascended, my pistol raised and braced, covering each turn of the staircase as Vibben had taught me. I came up to what a wall plaque told me was level 8. I could hear machine noise, industrial and heavy. Through another forced service door lay the walkways to the next galleries and a side access hatch of brushed grey adamite, which stenciled runes identified as the entrance to the main cryogenic generators. Smoke coughed, and noise rolled from the hatch. The cryogenerator chamber was vast, its roof reaching up into the pyramidal summit of Processional 212. The rumbling equipment it contained was ancient and vast. The data slate given to me in the ice car had said that the cryogenerators that ran the hibernation tombs of Hubris had originally been constructed to equip the Ark fleet that carried the first colonists to the world. They had been cut and salvaged from the giant Arks on arrival, and the stone tombs raised around them. A Technomagos Brotherhood, descended from the Ark fleet engineers, had kept the cryogenerators operating for thousands of years. This cryogenerator was 60 meters tall and constructed from cast iron and copper, painted in matte red lead paint. As it rose, it sprouted branches in the form of conduits and heat exchangers that intertwined with the roof vents. The hot air of the room vibrated with the noise of its operation. Smoke and steam wreathed the atmosphere, and sweat broke out on my brow and back the moment I stepped through the hatchway. I looked around and quickly noted where several inspection hatches had been levered away. The red paint was scored and scraped along each frame where a crowbar had been forced in, and hundreds of years of sacred unguents and Lex Mechanical sigil seals applied and tended by the Technomagi had been broken. I peered in through the open covers and saw rows of copper-wound cells, vibrating rack frames wet with black lubricant, sooty ganglions of insulated electrical routing, and dripping, lagged iron pipes. Sprung-jawed clips with biting metal teeth had been attached to some of the cells, and wiring from these clips trailed back to a small and obviously new ceramite module box taped inside the hatch frame. A digital runic display on the module flashed amber. This was where Eichlone's men had artificially triggered the revival process. That meant he had either turned and recruited local Technomagi or brought in experts from off-world. Either way, this signified considerable resources. I moved on and clambered up a ladder frame onto a raised platform of metal grill. There was something else here, a rectangular casket measuring about a meter and a half along its longest edge. It rested on four claw-like feet and had carrying handles built into its sides. The lid was open, and dozens of cables and leads snaked out, linking it to the cryogenerator's electromechanical guts, exposed by another prized-off hatch. I looked into the casket, but could make little sense of what I saw there. Circuit boards and complex mechanical elements linked by sheaves of cable. And there was a space, a padded recess in the heart of the casket's innards, clearly waiting to receive something the size of a clenched fist. Loose cable ends and plugs were taped in place, ready to be connected. But a key component of this mysterious device was evidently missing. My Voxlink chimed in my ear. It was Betancourt. I could barely hear him over the noise of the cryogenerator as he made a quick report in Glossier.
Aegis, heaven's uplift, thrice sevenfold, a crown with stars. Infamous angel without title to thorn by 8. Patton?
I considered. I was in no mood to take any more chances.
Thorn. Patton Hawk.
Patton Hawk acknowledged, he said with relish.
I saw movement from the corner of my eye about a half second after I broke the link with Betancourt. Another of Eichlone's black-eyed men, running in through the main hatch with an old model las pistol raised in his hand. His first shot, a twinkling ball of pink light, snapped the metal handrail of the platform I stood on with an explosive ping. His second and third passed over me as I dived down and ricocheted off the cast-iron side of the cryogenerator with scorching crackles. I returned fire, prone, but the angle was bad. Two more las shots came my way, one cutting sideways into the edge of the platform deck and cutting a gouge through the grill. The gunman was nearly at the foot of the ladder frame. Now a second gunman entered the chamber, calling out after the first, a powerful auto-rifle in his hands. He saw me and began to raise the weapon, but I had a cleaner angle on him and dropped him quickly with two rounds through the upper torso. The other was almost below me now, and fired a shot that punched clean through the grill just next to my right foot. I didn't hesitate. I went up and over the rail and directly down onto him. We crashed onto the chamber floor, the powerful impact throwing the Scipio out of my grasp despite my efforts to hold onto it. The man was jabbering some insane nonsense into my face and had a good grip on the front of my tunic. I had him by the throat and by the wrist of his gun hand, forcing the las pistol away. He fired it twice into the ceiling space above.
"Enough!" I commanded, modulating my tone to emphasize my will as I drove it into his mind. "Drop it!"
He did, meekly, as if surprised. Psycho tricks of will often baffle those who find themselves compelled by them. As he faltered, I threw a punch that connected well and left him unconscious on the floor. As I bent to recover the Scipio, Betancourt voxed me again.
"Aegis, Patton Hawk, infamous angel cast down."
Thorne acknowledged. "Resume Patton Crucible." I pushed on after my quarry. Eichlone made it into the upper vaults and out onto a landing platform built into the sloping side of Processional 212. The wind was fierce. Eichlone had eight of his cult with him, and they were expecting an orbital pinnace that would carry them away to safety. They had no way of knowing that, thanks to Betancourt, their means of escape was now burning in a deep impact gouge in the permafrost, about 8 kilometers north. What rose above the landing platform out of the blizzard night, its down thrusters wailing, was my gun cutter. 450 tons of armored alloy, 80 meters from barb nose to raked stern, landing gear still lowered like spider legs, it rose on the blue-hot downwash of angled jets. Banks of floodlights under its beak nose cut on and bathed the deck and the cultists in fierce white light. Panicking, some of them fired up at it. That was all the cue Betancourt needed. His temper was hot, his mind void of anything except the fact that Vibben was dead. The gun turrets in the ends of the stubby wings rotated and washed the platform with withering heavy fire. Stone splintered. Bodies were reduced to sprays of liquid. Eichlone, more intelligent than his men, had sprinted off the platform to the hatch as the gun cutter rose into view. And that's where he ran into me. He opened his mouth in shock as I pushed the muzzle of Vibben's gun into it. I'm sure he wanted to say something important. I didn't care what it was. I punched the gun so hard into his mouth the trigger guard broke his lower teeth. He tried to reach for something on his belt. I fired. Having emptied his brain case and shattered it into the bargain, the round still had so much force it crossed the deck and pinked off the armored nose of the hovering gun cutter just below the cockpit window. "Sorry," I said.
"Don't worry about it,"
Betancourt crackled back over the voxlink.
"Most perturbatory," said Amos.
It was his most frequent expression. He was hunched over, peering down into the casket on the cryogenerator chamber platform. Occasionally, he reached in to tinker with something, or leaned down for a closer look. Gestures such as these made the heavy augmetic eyeglasses clamped to his hooked nose make a soft dialing click as they auto-focused. I stood at his shoulder, waiting, looking down at the back of his old, bald head. The skin was liver-spotted and thin, and a narrow crescent of white hair edged the back of his skull. Uber Amos was my savant, and my longest-serving companion. He had come into my service in the first month of my career in the Inquisition, bequeathed to me by Inquisitor Hapshant, who was by then dying of cerebral worms. Amos was 278 standard years old, and had provided his services as a savant to 3 Inquisitors before me. He was alive only thanks to significant bionic augmentation to his digestive tract, liver, urinary system, hips and left leg. In Hapshant's service he had been injured by a stub round. tending him, surgeons had found a chronically advanced and previously undiagnosed cancer rampant in his abdomen. Had he not been shot, he would have died within weeks. Thanks to the wound, the disease was found, excised, and his body repaired with plastic, ceramite, and steel prosthetics. Amos referred to the whole ordeal as his lucky suffering, and still wore the twisted plug of the stub round that had almost taken and certainly saved his life on a chain around his stringy neck. Amos? He rose stiffly with a whine of bionics and turned to face me, shaking out the floor-length green folds of his embroidered robe. His augmetic eyewear dominated his ancient face. He sometimes reminded me of a curious insect with bulbous eyes and narrow, pinched mouthparts.
A codifier of unique design. A series processor, similar in layout to the mind impulse units used by the hallowed Adeptus Mechanicus to govern the linkage between human brain and god-machine.
You've seen such things? I asked, a little taken back.
Once in my travels, in passing. I do not pretend to have more than a cursory knowledge. I am certain, however, that the Adeptus Mechanicus would be interested in this device. It may be illicit technology or something derived from apparatus stolen from them. Either way, they would impound it.
Either way, they're not going to know about it. This is inquisitional evidence.
Quite so, he agreed.
There were distracting noises from below us. Tomb custodians and techno-magi from the Cryogenerator Brotherhood milled about in the chamber, supervising the mammoth and, in my opinion, futile operation to save the sleepers of Processional 212. The whole tomb seethed with activity, and the awful screams had not yet died down. I saw how Amos watched the work with keen interest, making notes to himself on a data slate strapped to his wrist. At the age of 42, he had contracted a meme virus that altered his brain function forever, driving him to collect information, any sort of information, whenever he got the chance. He was pathologically compelled to acquire knowledge, a data addict. That made him an aggravating, easily sidetracked companion, and a perfect savant, as four inquisitors had discovered.
Cold bolted steel cylinders,
he mused, looking up at the heat exchangers.
Is that to provide stress durability and temperature change, or was it fabrication expedient? Also, what is the range of temperature change given...
Amos, please. He looked back at me, remembering I was there. The casket?
Indeed, my apologies. A series processor. Did I say that?
Yes, processing what? Data?
I thought that at first. Then I considered some mental or mental transference process. But I doubt either now I've studied it.
I pointed down into the casket. What's missing?
Oh, you noticed that too. This is most perturbatory. I'm still not certain, of course, but it's something angular, non-standard in shape, and with its own power source.
You're sure?
There are no power inlets designed to couple to it, only power outlets. And there's something curious about the plugs. Non-standard mating. It's all non-standard.
Xenos?
No, human. Just non-standard. Custom-made.
Yeah, but for what? Asked Betancourt, climbing up the ladder frame to join us. He looked sour, his unruly black curls framing a dark-skinned, slender face that was usually alive with genial mischief.
I need to make further evaluations, Midas, said Amos,
hunching back over the casket. Betancourt stared my way. He was as tall as me, but lighter in build. His boots, breeches, and tunic were made of soft black leather with red piping, the old uniform of a Glavian pilot hunter. And over that he wore, as always, a short jacket of cerise silk with iridescent embroidery panels. His hands were gloved in light black hide, and seemed to wait ominously near the curved grips of the needle pistols holstered on his hips. "You took a long time getting here," I began.
"They made me take the cutter back to the landing cross at Tomb Point. Said they need the platform here for emergency flights. I had to walk back. Then I saw Dolores."
"She died well, Betancourt."
"Maybe. Is that possible?"
he added. I made no reply. I knew how deep his foul moods could be. I knew he had been in love with Loris Vibin, or at least had decided he was in love with her. I knew things would get difficult with Betancourt before they got better. Where is this off-welder, this Eisenhorn? The demanding voice rolled up from the chamber below us. I looked down. A man had entered the cryogenerator chamber, escorted by four custodians in heat gowns, carrying light poles aloft. He was tall, with pallid skin and greying hair, though his haughty bearing spoke of self-possession and arrogance. He wore a decorative ceremonial heat gown of bold yellow. I didn't know who he was, but he looked like trouble to me. Amos and Betancourt were watching him too. "Any idea as to who this is?" I asked Amos.
"Well, you see, the yellow robes, like the light poles carried by the custodians, symbolizes the return of the sun, and thus heat and light. It denotes a high-ranking official of the dormant custodial committee."
"I got that much myself," I muttered.
"Oh, well, his name is Nisimé Karpel, and he's high custodian, so you should address him as such. He was born here, on Vital 235, 50 standard years ago, the son of a—"
"Enough. I knew we'd get there eventually." I walked to the rail and looked down. "I am Eisenhorn." He stared up at me, barely contained wrath, bulging the veins in his neck. "Place him under arrest," he told his men.
Chapter 3 Nisimé Karpel. A light in endless darkness. The Pontius. I shot one meaningful glance at Betancourt to stay his hand, then calmly walked past him, slid down the ladder frame and approached Karpel. The custodians closed in around me, but at a distance. "Hi, custodian," I nodded. He fixed me with a steady but wary gaze and licked spittle off his thin lips.
"You will be detained until—"
"No," I replied. "I am an inquisitor of the God Emperor of Mankind, Ordo Xenos. I will cooperate in any investigation you bring to bear here, fully and completely. But you will not and cannot detain me. Do you understand?"
"An inquisitor?"
"Do you understand?" I repeated. I wasn't using my will at all, not yet. I would if I had to, but I trusted that he would have the sense to listen to me first. He could make things awkward for me, but I could make things intolerable for him. He seemed to soften a little. As I had judged, part of his rage came from shock at this incident, shock that so many planetary nobles in his care had suffered. He was looking for somewhere to pin the blame. Now he had to temper that with the idea that he was dealing with a member of the most feared institution in the Imperium.
"Thousands are dead," he began, a tremor in his voice. "This desecration, the highborn of hubris, violated by a murderer, a follower of darkness, a man who, thanks to me, lies dead now under a plastic sheet on the upper landing platform. I mourn the great loss hubris has suffered tonight, High Custodian, and I wish I had been able to prevent it. But if I had not been here at all to raise the alarm, well, imagine the tragedy you would be dealing with then." I let that sink in. "Not just this processional, but all the hibernation tombs. Who knows what Eiklone might have wrought? Who knows what his overall ambition was?
Eiklone? The recidivist?"
"He did this, High Custodian."
"You will brief me on this entire event. Let me prepare a report and bring it to you. You may have answers for me, too. I will signal you in a few hours for an appointment to meet. I think you have plenty to deal with right now."
We made our way out. Betancourt presented the junior custodians with a formal register of evidence to be stored for my inspection. The list included the casket and the bodies of Eiklone and his men. None would be tampered with, or even searched until I had looked at them. The gunman I had subdued in the cryogenerator chamber, the only one left alive, would be incarcerated pending my interrogation. Betancourt made these requirements abundantly clear. We took Vibben with us. Amos was too frail, so Betancourt and I handled the plastic-shrouded form on the gurney. We left Processional 212 by the main vault doors into the biting cold of the constant night and carried Vibben down towards a waiting ice car, taking her through the hundreds of rows of corpses the custodians were laying out on the frozen ground. My band and I had deployed onto Hubris the moment we arrived. Such was the urgency of our chase. Now it looked like we would remain here for at least a week,
longer if carpool proved difficult. As we rode the ice car back to the landing cross, I had Amos make arrangements for our stay. During dormant on Hubris, while 99% of the planetary population hibernates, one location remains active. The custodians and the techno-magi weather out the long, bitter darkness in a place called the Sun Dome. 50 kilometres from the vast expanse of the dormant plains, where the hibernation tombs stand in rows, the Sun Dome sits like a dark grey blister in the ongoing winter night. It is home to 59,000 people, just a town compared with the great empty cities that slumber below the horizon line, waiting for thaw to bring their populations back. I stared out at the Sun Dome as the gun cutter swept us in towards it through wind-blown storms of ice. Small red marker lights winked on the surfaces of the dome and from the masts jutting from the apex. Betancourt flew, silent, concentrating. He had removed his tight-fitting gloves so that the intricate Glavian circuitry set like silver inlays into his palms and fingertips could engage with the cutter's system directly via the control stick. Amos sat in a rear cabin, poring over manuscripts and data slates. Two independent multitask servitors waited for commands in the crew bay. The ship had five in all. Two were limbless combat units slaved directly to the gun pods, and the other, the chief servitor, a high-spec model we called Euclid, never left his duties in the engine room. Loink, my astropath, slumbered in his chamber, linked to the Vox and Pict systems, awaiting a summons. Vibben lay shrouded on the cot in her room. Betancourt swung the cutter down towards the dome. After an exchange of telemetry, a wide blast shutter opened in the side of the dome. The light that shone out was almost unbearably bright. Betancourt engaged the cockpit glare shields and flew us into the landing bay. The inside surface of the vast dome was mirrored. A plasma-effect sun globe burned high in the roof of the dome, bathing the town below in fierce white light. The town itself, spread out beneath us, seemed to be made of glass. We sat down on the wide bay, a 20-hectare metal platform that overlooked the town. The surface of the platform gleamed almost white in the reflected glare. Heavy monotask servitors trundled out and towed us into a landing silo off the main pad, where pit servitors moved in to attach fuel lines and begin fundamental servicing. Betancourt didn't want anybody or anything touching the gun cutter, so he ordered Modo and Nilquit, our two independent servitors, to take over the tasks and send the locals away. I could hear them moving around the hull, servos whirring, hydraulics hissing, exchanging machine code data bursts with each other, or with Euclid in the drive chamber. Amos offered to find accommodation for us in the town itself, but I decided a landing berth was all we needed. The gun cutter was large enough to provide ample facilities for our stay. We often spent weeks or months living aboard it. I went to Loing's small cabin under the cockpit deck and roused him. He hadn't been with me long. My previous astropath had been killed trying to translate a warp cipher 6 weeks before. Loing was a young man, with a fleshy, unhealthy bulk hanging from a thin, skeletal frame. His body already deteriorating from the demands of a psyker's life. Greasy implant plugs dotted his shaved skull and lined his forearms like short spines. As he came to the door, some of these plugs trailed wires, each marked with parchment labels, which led back to the communications main box above his cradle. Thousands of cables spilled or dangled around his tiny cabin, but he instinctively knew what each one did and could set and adjust plug-ins at a moment's notice. The room reeked of sweat and incense. "Master," he said. His mouth was a wet pink slit, and he had one lazy, half-hooded eye that gave him a superior air, quite belying his actual timidity. "Please send a message for me, Loink, to the Regal Aquitaine." The Regal was a rogue trader we had employed to convey the gun cutter and ourselves to Hubris. His vessel awaited us in orbit now, ready to provide further warp passage. "Give Trademaster Gulquin my respects and tell him we are staying for now. He can be on his way. There's no point in him waiting. We could be here for a week or more. The usual form, polite. Tell him I thank him for his service and hope we may meet again." Loink nodded.
"I will do it at once."
"Then I'd like you to perform some other tasks. Contact the main Astropathicus enclave here on Hubris, and request a full transcript of off-world traffic for the past 6 weeks. Also, any record of unlicensed traffic, individuals using their own astropaths. Whatever they can make available, and a little threat that it is an Inquisitor requiring this data wouldn't hurt. They don't want to find themselves caught up in a major Inquisition for withholding information. He nodded again.
Will you be requiring an auto-seance?
Not yet, but I will eventually. I will give you time to prepare.
Will that be all, Master?
I turned to go. Yes, Loing.
Master?
He paused.
Is it true that the female Vibin is dead?
Yes, Loing.
Ah, I thought it was quiet.
He closed the door. The comment wasn't as callous as it sounded. I knew what he meant, though my own psychic abilities were nascent and undeveloped next to his. Laris Vibin was a latent psyker, and while she had been with us, there had been a constant background sound, almost subliminal, broadcast unconsciously by her young, eager mind. I found Betancourt outside, standing under the shadow of one of the guncutter's stubby wings. He was gazing at the ground, smoking a low-leaf tube. I didn't approve of narcotics, but I let it go. He'd cleaned himself up these past few years. When I'd first met him, he had been an obscura user.
"Damn bright place," he muttered,
wincing out at the abominable glare.
"A typical overreaction. They have 11 months of pitch dark, so they like their habitat to an excessive degree."
"Do they have a night cycle?"
"I don't believe so."
"No wonder they're so messed up. Extreme light, extreme dark, extreme mindsets. Their body clocks and natural rhythms must be all over the place."
I nodded. Outside, I had begun to be disarmed by the notion that the night was never going to end. Now I had the same feelings about this constant noon. In his brief, Amos had said the world was called Hubris because after spending 70 standard years getting here aboard their Ark fleet, the original colonists had found the surveys had been incorrect. Instead of enjoying a regular orbit, the world they had selected pursued this extreme pattern of darkness and light. They'd settled anyway, co-opting the cryogenerational methods that had got them here as part of their culture. A mistake, in my view. But I wasn't here to offer a cultural critique. "Notice anything?" I asked Betancourt. He made a casual gesture around the landing platform.
"They don't get many visitors in this season. Trade's all but dead. The world's on tick-over."
"Which is why Iclone thought it vulnerable."
"Yes. Most of the ships here are local. Trans-atmospheric. Some are for the custodian's use. The others are simply berthed up over dormant. I make 3 non-locals, aside from us. 2 trader launches and a private cutter."
"Ask around. See if you can find out who they belong to and what their business is."
"Sure thing."
"Iclone's pinnace, the one you shot down. Did it come from here?" He took a suck on his narc tube and shook his head.
"Either came from orbit or up from some private location. Loing picked up its transmissions to Iclone."
"I'll ask to see those. But it could have come from orbit. Iclone may have a starship up there."
"Don't worry. I already thought to look. If there was one there, it's gone, and it made no signals."
"I'd like to know how that bastard got here, and how he was intending to leave again."
"I'll find that out,"
said Betancourt, crushing the tube stud under his heel. He meant it.
"What about Vibin?"
he asked. "Do you know what her wishes were?" "She never mentioned anything to me. Did she want her remains sent back to Tornish for burial?"
"You'd do that."
"If that was what she wanted. Is it?"
"I don't know, Eisenhorn. She never told me either."
"Take a look through her effects. See if she left any testament or instructions. Can you do that?"
"I'd like to do that,"
he said. I was tired by then. I spent another hour with Amos in his cramped, data-slate-filled room, preparing a report for Karpel. I set out the basic details, reserving anything I felt he didn't need to know. I accounted for my actions. I made Amos check them against local law to prepare myself in case Karpel raised a prosecution. I wasn't unduly worried about him, and in truth I was bulletproof against local legislation, but I wanted to check anyway. An Amalathian prides himself on working with the structures of Imperial society,
not above or beyond them, or through them, as a monodominant might. I wanted Karpel and the senior officials of Hubris on my side, helping my investigation. When my report was complete, I retired to my room. I paused by Vibben's door, went in, and gently placed the Scipio naval pistol between her hands on her chest, folding the shroud back afterwards. It was hers. It had done its work. It deserved to be laid to rest with her. For the first time in 6 years, I did not dream about Eichlone. I dreamed of a blinding darkness, then a light that refused to go away. There was something dark about the light. Nonsense, I know, but that was how it felt, like a revelation that actually carried some grimmer, more profound truth. There were flashes like lightning around the edges of my dream's horizon. I saw a handsome, blank-eyed male, not blank-eyed like one of Eichlone's drones, but vacant, like an immense starless distance. He smiled at me. At that time in my life, I had no idea who he was. I went to see Karpel at noon the next day. It was always noon in the Sun Dome, but this was real noon by the clock. By then, Loink, Amos, and Betancourt had all dredged up new information for me. I shaved and dressed in black linen with high boots and a formal jacket of scaled brown hide. I wore my inquisitorial rosette at my throat. I intended to show Karpel I meant business. Amos and I descended from the landing platform superstructure by caged elevator and found yellow-robed custodians waiting to escort us. Despite the rancid white light all around, they still held ignited light poles. We made short, hard shadows on the dry rockcrete of the concourse as we crossed to an open limousine. It was a massive chrome-grilled beast with pennants bearing the Hubris crest fluttering on its cowling. There were four rows of overstuffed leather benches behind the center-set driver's cockpit. We hummed through the streets on 8 fat wheels. The boulevards were wide and, needless to say, bright. To either hand, glass-fronted buildings rose towards the blazing plasma sun globe high above, like flowers seeking the light. Every 30 meters along every street, chemical lamps on ornate posts strained to add their own light to the brilliance. Traffic was sparse, and there were at most a few thousand pedestrians on the streets. I noticed most wore yellow silk sashes, and that garlands of yellow flowers decorated every lamp post.
"The flowers?" I asked.
"From the hydroponic farms on East Dome 7, one of the custodians told me.
"Signifying?"
"Morning."
"Same as the sashes," Amos whispered in confidence. "What happened last night is a major tragedy for this world. Yellow is their holy colour. I believe the local religion is a solar belief."
"The sun as emperor?"
"Common enough. Extreme here, for obvious reasons."
The custodial hall was a glass spire close to the town centre, a solar disk overlaid with the double-headed eagle of the Imperium, decorating its upper faces. Nearby was the local chapel of the Ecclesiarchy, and several buildings given over to the Imperial Administratum. It amused me to see they were all built of black stone and virtually windowless. Those Imperial servants stationed here obviously had as little truck with me, with the constant light. We drew in under a glass portico and were escorted into the main hall. It was seething with people, most of them custodians in yellow robes, some local officials and techno-magi, some clerks and servitors. The hall itself was of the scale of an imperial chapel, but raised in yellow-stained glass on a frame of black cast iron. The air was full of golden light shafting down through the glass. The carpet was vast, black, with a sun disk woven into its centre.
"Inquisitor Eisenhorn,"
declared one of my escorts through a vox hailer. The hall fell silent, and all turned to watch us approach. High custodian Karpel sat in a hovering lifter throne with gilt decorations. A burning chemical light was mounted above the head of the floating chair. He swung in through the parting crowd towards me. "High custodian," I said with a dutiful nod.
"They are all dead," he informed me. "All 12,142. Processional 212 is dead. None survived the trauma. Hubris has my sincere sympathies, High Custodian. The hall exploded in pandemonium, voices screeching and shouting and clamouring.
Your sympathies! Your damned sympathies! Karpel screamed above the roar. A great part of our ruling elite die in one night, and we have your sympathies to console us!
That is all I can offer, High Custodian. I could feel Amos shivering at my side, making aimless notes on his wrist slate about custom and clothing and language forms, anything to take his mind from the confrontation.
That's hardly good enough, spat a young man nearby.
He was a local noble, young and firm enough, but his skin had a dreadful sweaty pallor, and Custodian supported him as he stumbled forward. Who are you? I asked.
Vernal Maypel, Air Lord of the Dalowen Cantons.
If he expected me to fall to my knees in supplication, he was in for a disappointment.
Because of the gravity of this event, we have roused some of our high-born early from their dormancy, Karpel said. Liege Maypel's brother and two of his wives died in processional 212.
So the pallor was revival sickness. I noticed that 50 or more of the congregation present were similarly wasted and ill. I turned to Maypel. Liege, I repeat, you have my condolences. Maypel exploded with rage.
Your arrogance astounds me, Offwelder. You bring this monster to our world, battle with him through our most sacred sanctums, a private war that slaughters our best, and you—
Wait! I used my will. I didn't care. Maypel stopped as if stunned, and the vast hall rang silent. I came here to save you and deny Eichlone's plans. But for the efforts of myself and my companions, he might have destroyed more than one of your hibernation tombs. I broke none of your laws. I was careful to preserve your codes in pursuit of my work. What do you mean I brought this monster here?
We have made inquiries,
answered an elderly noblewoman nearby. Like Maypel, she was ailing with revival sickness and sat hunched on a litter carried by slaved servitors. What inquiries, madam?
This long feud with the murderer Eichlone. 5 years, is it now?
6, lady.
6, then. You have hounded him here. Driven him. Brought him, as Liege Maypel said.
How?
We registered no off-world ship these past 20 days, except yours, Eisenhorn, Karpel said, reviewing a data slate. The Regal Aquitaine. That ship must have brought him as it brought you, to finish your war here and damn our lives. Did you choose Hubris because it was quiet, out of the way, a place where you might finish your feud undisturbed in the long dark?
I was angry by now. I concentrated to control my rage.
Amos?
Beside me, he was muttering.
And what silicate dyes do they use in their stained glass manufacture? Is the structure armoured? The supports are early Imperial Gothic in style, but—
Amos, the report!
He started and handed me a data slate from his leather case.
Read this, Karpel. Read it thoroughly. I pushed it at him, then snatched it away as he reached for it. Or should I read it aloud to all here assembled? Should I explain how I came here at the last minute, when I learned Eichlone was moving to Hubris? That I learned that only by astropathic decryption of a cipher message sent by Eichlone 2 months ago? A cipher that killed my astropath in his efforts to translate it?
Inquisitor, I—
Karpel began. I held up the data slate report for them all, thumbing the stud that scrolled the words across the screen. And what about this? The evidence that Eichlone has been planning a move against your world for almost a year. And this. Gathered this last night. That an unregistered starship moved in and out of your orbit to deliver Eichlone 3 days ago, unnoticed by your planetary overwatch and the custodian Guardians. Or the itemized stream of astropathic communication that your local enclave noticed but didn't bother to source or translate. I tossed the slate into Karpel's lap. Hundreds of eyes stared at me in shocked silence.
You are wide open. He exploited you. Don't blame me for anything except being too late to stop him. As I said, you have my sincere condolences.
And next time you choose to confront an Imperial Inquisitor, I added,
You may want to be more respectful. I'm excusing a lot because I recognize the trauma and loss you have suffered. But my patience isn't limitless. Unlike my authority. I turned to Karpel. Now, High Custodian, can we talk in private, as I think I requested?
We followed Karpel's floating throne into a side annex, leaving a hall full of murmuring, shocked voices behind us. Only one of his men accompanied us, a tall, blonde fellow in a dark brown uniform I didn't recognize. A bodyguard, I presumed. Karpel set his throne down on the carpet and raised a remote wand that tinted the glass plates of the room at a touch. Reasonable light levels at last. From that alone I knew Karpel was taking me seriously. He waved me to a seat opposite. Amos lurked in the shadows behind me. The man in brown stood by the windows, watching. "What happens now?" Karpel asked. "I expect your full cooperation as I extend my investigation."
"But the matter is over," said the man in brown.
I kept my gaze on Karpel. "I want your consent for me to continue, as well as your full cooperation. Eichlone may be dead, but he was just the blade point of a long and still dangerous weapon."
"What are you talking about?"
the man in brown snapped. Still, I didn't.